Before we go over the pre-lab for this experiment, I wanted to go over just a little bit of the syllabus. Now, for those of you who are returning, most of the syllabus is pretty much identical to the one from last quarter, but just for the couple of new people, I want to go over some of the core part of the syllabus. Did everybody get the email that the syllabus had been posted? Okay, if you didn't get the email, let me know, because that means there's an incorrect address in your banner information. We want to get that updated. So, on the syllabus, there's different color codings for some of the different sections. The core information's the stuff that's in the purple borders, the first few pages here. So, let me cover this. The contact information. I did update that to include the Twitter address that I'm using to announce that things have been posted. For the Facebook group, I think I had mentioned that. And Marvin came to this section the other day, correct? So if you contact either me or him, then we can add you to that group. Yes. Oh, okay, good. All right. And then here we have a description of the course. I'll let you just read that. Class structure, this is the single section class. You may be aware there are two other sections, but this is going to be a completely different section. And at some points in the quarter, we're actually going to be at a slightly different pacing than them. So as far as quizzes and exams, you need to do all of those in just this section, not in either of the other sections. Grading, same structure as last quarter. There'll be three quizzes, each for 33 points, and then 1 point added in to round that up to 100. There'll be three exams, each for 150 points. That adds up to 450. And then the final, which is 200 points. And so all of that together is 750 points. Then for the lab, we have 9 scheduled experiments, but we'll probably just do lab reports for 8 of them. So 10 points each, making 80 points. There'll be 1 lab notebook check. So 20 points, bringing that up to 100 total. And then we have 2 lab exams. They'll be worth 75 points each. That's 150 more points. That makes it for 250 points total for the lab. Now, one small change from last quarter, which matches what I used to have as a policy in the past, but somehow it dropped off of my green sheet in my multiple edits. You need to complete all of the experiments to pass the class. Now, if you're absent for some legitimate reason, then you're not going to fail if you miss that one lab. But this clause was in there because when I first started teaching here, there were some people that didn't like lab, but they did really well in lecture. So even though they didn't do some of the experiments, they still did well in the course. So it's just to ensure that you do all the experiments. But the other part that's new for this quarter compared to last quarter is point-wise, you also have to pass the lab, which I don't think anybody would have had any problem with that last quarter. But in other words, make sure you don't totally ignore the lab exams. Kathleen, question. Well, we have 2 lab exams, right? So we'll have one in the middle of the quarter. Oh, yeah, I've noticed that yesterday. There is a mistake there. It really should be a 2. And there's so one in the middle of the quarter, one at the end of the quarter. That's how we get 150 points. So I guess I'll go back and there's actually one other tiny error I made somewhere. I may upload a slightly corrected version. This course is not graded on a curve. Now, that doesn't mean I might not curve individual assignments. So I think I might have already mentioned that there was quite a liberal curve that I applied both to the third exam and to the final last quarter. So I might curve an individual assignment. But in terms of the overall grade, I don't curve those, meaning I'm not looking to try to assign a certain number of A's, B's, C's, or D's. So that means if you all do really, really well, you could potentially all get A's, and if you all do no work whatsoever, well, you all would get less than that. Any questions on this front page? Okay, moving along then. There are some deadlines as far as registration is concerned, and the campus is far more strict about these deadlines than they used to be because we've gotten some amount of trouble for not adhering closely enough to these deadlines. So you're already in the course, first deadline doesn't matter. If you need to drop this course, if you're an out-of-state student, the deadline to do it by which to get your money back is this Friday. If you're an in-state student to get your money back, it's the following Friday, end of the second week. If you wanted to drop the course after that, but you won't get your money back, you can go to the third Friday. And then after that, there is this pass-fail deadline, which I don't know if it applies to anyone in this course, and that's kind of the point where we instructors don't actually know who's taking a course pass-fail. We just submit the grades as is at the end of the quarter, and then the computer system automatically converts that to pass-fail if that's how you take it. But if you needed or wanted to take it that way, you've got it designated by that deadline, because after that point, you can't go back and convert it either direction. There is one last deadline, March 2nd, that is the withdrawal deadline. So withdrawal is if you drop the course, but after the drop deadline, but you still have a chance to get out of the course without getting a grade assigned. Now, I know these W's, which there is a W that shows up in your transcript when you withdraw versus when you drop, there's nothing that shows up. W's can, in theory, have a negative impact if you have a whole bunch of them, but and I'm hoping you don't end up in this situation, but if you think there's some chance that there's no way you're going to pass the course, an F never looks better than a W. So if you are in that situation, take the W, don't take an F. The exam and quiz schedule, I've got that posted already. And we're mostly tracking the first two sections, but at some point you have less days off, I think, than they do, just because of the way holidays fall. So we'll get off track at some point. The final exam, I think I did mention it on Tuesday, but I just wanted to confirm it is Thursday, I guess that would be the third day of finals, March 29th at 11:30 a.m., and it'll be in this classroom. So same as your normal lecture time. Different kinds of assignments. You can read the summary there for the new people. I don't collect homework, so I don't know if I mentioned it. You are free to use whatever lecture textbook you might want to because I don't collect particular assignments. If you don't have a text, I recommend getting the one that's listed just because you can better follow our flow. But as you're going to see in a moment, in fact, we're going to be jumping around a fair bit this quarter. And that's for a couple of reasons. The author of this text takes not a totally unusual approach, but still somewhat novel approach to how she organizes different functional groups. So, in fact, we're going to start talking about carbonyls today. We're going to start talking about aldehydes and ketones. Well, aldehydes and ketones actually have reactivity that's really similar to carboxylic acids and many of the carboxylic acid derivatives. The main difference in the reactivity would be the fact that a carbonyl in an aldehyde and a ketone only has either carbon or hydrogen attached on either side. But in these carboxylic acid derivatives, there's what's known as a heteroatom, something that's neither carbon nor hydrogen. And that imparts a different kind of reactivity. But there is an overall pattern of reactivity for that carbonyl, and that's how the author has organized the text. But what's unusual, therefore, is she presents the carboxylic acids and derivatives first, where in most texts it's aldehydes and ketones. So there'll be a fair bit of chapter jumping, and there'll be portions of sections even that we might skip, just because all of that carboxylic acid information is really for 12C. That's the way our curriculum is written. There's also the problem of benzene. Benzene does have its special reactivity. And so it's not that it needs to be ignored, it's just it's totally different reactivity than any of the other functional groups that we study. So it's like, well, where do you put it? And so some people put it earlier in the course. I tend to put it later in the course because I like covering alcohols, aldehydes, and ketones because we're going to learn how to convert them back and forth between each other. In fact, the first lab today is to take an alcohol, turn it into a ketone, and the next lab is to take a ketone and turn it back into an alcohol. So, don't get thrown off by the fact that we're jumping around, because for the most part, the way the text is written, fortunately, there are not going to be that many things that you're going to be stumped reading because you didn't read the earlier sections that we skipped. So, there is the lecture schedule with the different types of problems I've suggested. I've also done a breakdown of... Oh, sorry, yes. Because I'm going out of town to a conference, actually. So had the opportunity, wanted to take it. I know that means missing a little bit of class, but that's why we're missing it. So yes, you're going to have an extremely short week next week. This section will only meet on Tuesday. Now the second chart that's here, this is a list of the individual topics that I recommend that you make sure that you study. Now I put a disclaimer in here that this is not the exclusive list of the only things that you are responsible for on a quiz or an exam. And for the couple of new people, the general rule is you don't have to ask me what's going to be on a quiz or exam, because anything that I present in class, that's the material on the exam. So that means if we skip something in the book, if we don't cover something in the book, it's not on the quiz or exam. So, but don't take this as the exclusive list of topics, but use this as sort of a guidepost, what main things to focus on or what concepts to organize your notes around. There is the lab schedule here, and you'll notice that I've tried to include information as far as which parts we're going to do. So those of you who like to be prepared way ahead of time, if when you prepare your pre-lab, you just know which parts not to do so you don't waste your time. So this is the core part of the syllabus. We may cover some of the rest of it another day, but are there any questions on what we covered? Okay. Then let's switch over to... I'm sorry. There are a couple of things I got to mention, because further down there's a section that's in yellow, and that's the lab section. It includes lab safety, but I think it also includes a few of my pet peeves. And particularly for the new people, but a gentle reminder for the returning people as well. There's some things that will particularly annoy me this quarter. One of them, as you can well guess, is the balance area, which I can see that either the instructor last night or someone else came in to reorganize the area a little bit. I do notice there's little flecks of chemicals here, which the section one got the soapbox lecture that you're about to, and then they promptly ignored me, which made me worry that, okay, maybe I really have to do what I'm going to describe what I'm going to do. The problem is with the chemicals over here, besides the fact that it's not cool to be sloppy like that. If this is not your own environment, you're just here temporarily, why come to make a mess and expect someone else to clean it up? Besides that, the chemicals that we're going to be using are going to get more and more hazardous. For example, there's this compound, aluminum trichloride, which many of you might have used aluminum trichloride as a solution back in 1A, and in solution it's not so bad. But the powder itself, it's kind of like borate. It's got an element in the middle that doesn't have a complete octet, so it's really, really reactive. If you open up the bottle of aluminum trichloride and just wave a piece of pH paper over it, it'll turn pink, because there's that much hydrochloric acid being released because the aluminum trichloride is decomposing in air. I'll say that again. It's decomposing to make hydrochloric acid, which itself is a noxious corrosive compound. So when that lab comes, if this area turns into what often does, which at like half an hour into the lab, it looks like someone took a bag of chemicals and just sprinkled it all over. Then that means anybody that's walking past this is just getting this cloud of hydrochloric acid. Now, do you really want to be working in an environment like that? Hopefully not. Then why is it that every quarter, every section, almost every lab period, there ends up being the mess over here that there does? It really is not a safe situation, and the older I'm getting, I guess the less cool that I'm getting and the more irritated I get by things like that. If nothing else, that I wonder what's going to happen when you all graduate, get jobs, and in this economy, if you were to work in a place and make a mess like this, how long do you think it would be in a place like that? So, the policy, unfortunately, is going to be this. At whatever point I walk over here, not just at the end of lab when I know you all are scrambling to try to clean up and get out and make things look pretty, but any point during the lab, if I come over here and it's a huge mess, then I'm going to just have to give zeros on the lab report for that experiment. And that's because even if I diligently walked around continuously while you're doing lab, if I'm over there for a couple minutes, I'm not going to see what's over here. There's 26 of you, there's one of me. I can't keep track of what's going on, but you each are individually responsible. So I said that same thing to section one.
there was a big mess over here when I walked over at some point. And I don't know what I said, but it was something along the lines of, did you really not get the point of what I had said? Did you really just ignore me that quickly? Tell me why I shouldn't give everybody zeros. Don't make me do the same thing with you all. Now, something else that's equally frustrated me over the years. Is storage of chemicals. And I know that partly what happens is you all are in a rush. There's not much time for you to do experiments. You're in a hurry. There's 10 other people breathing down your neck for the balances. And so I can understand why, in some sense, some of these things happen. But something like a chemical bottle, so often, I already saw it yesterday, people will close bottles by just taking the cap and leaving it like this. If this was a bottle of methiol, well, I wouldn't be giving you a bottle of methiol to play with. But if this was a bottle of methiol, and you left the cap just sitting like this, and you put it down here, about 5 minutes later, we'd have to evacuate this whole building because of how bad it would smell. Human noses are really, really sensitive to sulfur, so it just would be overpowering beyond belief. Why is it then that this is considered okay? Because you are going to be using other compounds, liquid compounds, that'll do the same thing like aluminum trichloride does. Acetyl chloride, when you use it, if you let it sitting open, it'll smell like salad in here because it decomposes into acetic acid, but at the same time it also decomposes into hydrochloric acid. Again, big cloud of hydrochloric acid vapor. So you just got to take the half second it takes to close this. If someone else is behind you didn't realize it, then they've wasted a whole second and a half to open it again. But at least we're being a lot more safe. Now, something a little bit lower on the smack you around ladder, but something that does have legal implications, is this cart over here. So there are various acids and bases that we use that you'll use in multiple experiments. And just to make it a little easier on the stock room, instead of having to switch the bottles in and out for every experiment, you just leave them over here and you use them as you need them. Notice, though, that the different acids have big tubs that they're in, and that's called secondary containment. And we're required to have that for liquids because the idea is this. We're in an earthquake zone. What if we had an earthquake and somehow one of these bottles breaks because some of them are glass? Well, in that case, you don't want something like concentrated acid pouring over everything to possibly cause a big side reaction, an unwanted reaction. So instead, we keep it in the secondary containment so that if it breaks, it just stays there. The contamination doesn't go so far. Well, along with the idea that you're trying to keep that contained, that means you also need to keep only compatible chemicals in that same secondary containment. You don't want to put an acid in the base that both might break together to then encourage a reaction. So when you use this, realize that there's even different color coatings on these different bottles so that we can keep the different acids and bases separate from each other, particularly the bases separate from the acids, but the different kinds of acids even separate from each other. What ends up happening, again, because people are in a rush, is someone takes a bottle out and just puts it on the top of the table, doesn't take the time to put it away. Particularly the bases. Realize the bases are, I think, all on the bottom shelf there. And some of you are about half my age now, and so you have the ability to bend down and put the bottle back on that lower shelf. Don't take it, just plop it down on the top here because you're too busy to be able to bother to put it away. If an inspector came in, it's a safety violation, something we could be written up for. But this one, I guess it's so congested, I guess I give up at some point, but you really need to be separating these out. The last comment I'll make, I think you all saw the new toy maybe already. This waste area has been target practice, meaning, did I already give this form of the speech? Not this form, okay. Meaning that I come over here and I see these nice, pretty, blue spill catches that the stockroom puts out that looks like it's been dipped in oil within just a couple of days because some of that problem, and the fact that we have such a huge acetone usage. And, you know, this is one of those other things that one of these days I'll figure out how to communicate this thought. That if you have a 100-milliliter beaker and you fill it up with 90 milliliters of liquid to clean it, you're not going to be doing much cleaning because you can't even slosh it around because all the liquid just falls. So how much acetone you're wasting because you're just filling that beaker all the way down. We could even mathematically go through, we didn't do it last quarter, but partition coefficients, you could use it to prove it that if you extract something with a small amount of liquid but you do it multiple times, the effect is far greater than if you even used one huge portion of liquid. But since I can't seem to communicate that thought, the other instructors had that same problem, we sort of shortchanged that, and we have this acetone bag, which we have this bucket on the inside. So we have this bucket that you put your glassware in, you then submerge this into the acetone, let it sit around for 5 minutes or so, then once you're done, pull it back out, pull the glassware out, and well, hopefully you've got clean glassware. Now, since most of the chemicals in the experiment that we use, we end up dumping into something anyways and eventually dumping into a waste bottle, most of your glassware is not going to be so dirty that we, what I'm trying to say is this could be reused over and over and over and over again. So we're going to have the same acetone here, but greatly therefore reduce the amount of acetone that we need to use. So this is going to be in the back pupillet, but because of that, we have a problem with where do we put the waste bottles. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the waste bottles off and put them up the front of the classroom here. There'll be one for aqueous, one for organic. Haven't labeled it acid and base yet because I need to do a pH determination to make sure which kind it is. But for the moment, therefore, just put all the aqueous waste together. I think that's the last lab-related thing that I've got. So any questions before now we really do start the lab lecture? Okay. Since we are synthesizing a ketone today, I wanted to take a few minutes to go over the nomenclature of aldehydes and ketones to get it out of the way so we can focus tomorrow in lecture on how ketones and aldehydes react. So, before we can get there, let's just review the fact that a carbonyl bond is a carbon-oxygen double bond. And it is the central feature of both an aldehyde and a ketone. For an aldehyde, it's a functional group where the carbonyl must have at least one hydrogen attached to it. And so R in this case could be usually an alkyl group, or technically it could be another hydrogen, in which case it would be the molecule formaldehyde, also called methanol. Yes? This is lab lecture. Well, actually, the nomenclature might be something that will show up in lecture. So I guess I should have said that before you started writing these notes. So this nomenclature, it's really, I guess you'd say, a lecture topic. So if you're keeping your lab and lecture notes separately, maybe switch over to your lecture notes. For the new people, I recommend not putting your lab notes, by the way, in your lab book for two reasons. One, if and when I collect the lab books, you'll be without those notes for a while. And then two, the lab notebooks get lost a lot more frequently than lecture notebooks. So just a suggestion. Back to this. I want to emphasize the fact that at least one hydrogen has to be connected to the carbonyl.
That's versus a ketone, where we still have a carbonyl, but both of the groups attached to the carbonyl must be an alkyl group. Now we'll discuss tomorrow the fact that aldehydes, by having just the hydrogen on one side, end up being more reactive than ketones. And in fact, that shows up in a sense in the order of priority that we assign to different functional groups. So if we're talking about nomenclature, we got to remember that the ending of a name, you normally can only reflect one type of functional group. The exception is if you have carbon-carbon double or triple bonds. That's shown in what's called the stem, the A-N, E-N, or Y-N part of a name. Otherwise, though, there's just one functional group name that we have. So the functional group priority is that aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. And part of the reason of this, the priority, or part of the way it was constructed, is on the types of bonds that are in the functional groups. So the lowest priority are just hydrocarbons, whether they have single, double, or triple bonds. Then there's what I call the saturated groups. So alcohols, for example, thiols, those are more important. Then these are unsaturated groups, having a carbonyl. Above these are those different carboxylic acids that also have yet another atom on a carbonyl. So aldehydes, then ketones, then alcohols, and then alkenes and alkynes. So let's do just some aldehydes first. The functional group ending for an aldehyde is al, A-L. And notice that if an aldehyde is something that has to have a hydrogen attached to the carbonyl, that automatically that makes it a primary, the one position, and so there's no numbers needed when naming aldehydes. So this compound is simply called butanal. If we had two aldehydes, they'd still both have to be at opposite ends of the molecule automatically. So this is butane diol. Now let's see a few polyfunctional molecules where we have more than one functional group. First, let's see how does the name change if we have an alkene. Now, nomenclature problems last quarter, one common mistake that I noticed that came up, particularly with alcohols, is do you keep this N that's here or not? And the answer is yes, because the AN or EN or YN shows whether you do have any carbon-carbon single versus double versus triple bonds. The only thing that changes is what comes after the N. And the only exception to that are these alkoxy groups that we're going to learn how to name in lecture today. So coming back to this compound, we have two functional groups that from either direction, one or the other of them could be numbered with the number one. But aldehydes are a more important functional group, so therefore we're going to give the aldehyde position number one and give the alkene, therefore, position number three. So the name of this will be but-3-ene-al. What if we had an alcohol instead? Well, I was saying earlier how you can't have more than one main functional group ending, and alcohols normally get the all ending. Well, so there's a different name we use to make an alcohol a substituent. And that is hydroxy. Now, the word hydroxyl with an L is used in some situations, but not in this normal nomenclature. So normally we're going to use the term hydroxy. Notice we have a stereocenter. Is it R or S? Ooh, I heard two answers. I'll ask that again. Is this R or S? Did I just hear two answers again? We have oxygen, which is the most important atom in the molecule. We have carbon, which is attached to something besides hydrogen. And then we have carbon that's only attached to hydrogen. So if we're going 1, 2, 3 like this, that is R. And the hydrogen is pointed away from us the way it's supposed to be. Since there's only one stereocenter, we can name it without numbers. So we just say R. The hydroxy group is less important than the aldehyde, so it's again at the 3 position. Name it as a substituent. And then we have the main compound name, butanal. Did I put an L there? Even when I said ignore the L? Wow. Hydroxy. Now let's see an example of having an alkene and an alcohol together on an aldehyde, which is not such an unusual combination. Now we have a stereocenter again, which we'll get to in just a moment, but we also now have an alkene that has the potential to have isomers, doesn't it? Even if we kept the double bond between the same two carbons, can't we make a structural isomer of that double bond? So that means we need some term, cis or trans or E or Z, to describe it. Can we use the term cis and trans in this case to describe the configuration of that double bond? Seeing people say yes. Why yes? Because you have only one R group on either carbon. There's only one substituent on either side, or there's a hydrogen on either side. Can we use the term cis and trans to name the whole molecule, which is a different question? The answer is yes, because there's only one double bond that we have to specify. It's if there's multiple things that would need the term cis or trans that we can't use the term cis and trans to name something. However, since we already have a stereocenter, to me it makes more sense to use the EZ nomenclature, because then we could put everything in the one set of parentheses that shows all the different stereo descriptors. So would this be E or Z? It is E, which I was surprised in each of the sections there seemed to be that delay there. And I don't know if it's because of the zigzag way I drew the double bond, but it seemed to help when I drew the hydrogens in. That seems to help show that, yes, they're really trans, and trans is the same as E, which if you can't remember which one of those is which, just remember that when you have on the zane, zine, zen, is like ziz. In other words, Z's is on the same side, Zide, Zis, Zusammen, Z, Cis. If nothing else, you'll remember being totally confused by that, and then you'll never forget again what it is. So, if this is now E, let's figure out what the stereocenter's configuration is. Is it R or S? Well, I heard R and I heard S, and you got a 50-50 chance. This is one we have to answer using phantom atoms, isn't it? Because we have to figure out how to tackle the priority of a double bond. To make it systematic the way that we tackle double and triple bonds, we rewrite it using an echoed atom, you could say. That if a carbon has got a double bond with a carbon, rewrite it as if it's connected to two carbons. If it was connected double bond with an oxygen, then we'd write it as if it's connected with two oxygens. So let's rewrite this molecule to do that analysis properly. So I've expanded out just the carbons we had in the unsaturation there. Written the hydrogens in, and then let's add those phantom carbons. Now the hydroxy group is going to automatically be priority one. Then there's a hydrogen that's in back. That's the way it should be. The lowest priority group's in back, so I won't even bother writing it in. And we are trying to decide then between the two different carbon chains that are attached. Well, the way that this works, it's the first point of difference rule, meaning you only go out as far as you need to find some difference in the structure of the two substituents that you're comparing. So we started out right next to the stereocenter. We find that we've got carbon on the left-hand side, carbon on the right-hand side. So we can't use that atom to decide. So that's why we go one more step out. On the right, we've got one carbon attached there, but otherwise we just have two hydrogens. On the left, we've got a carbon that's the phantom, another carbon that's the real atom, and a hydrogen. But that means, on the left, we have priority order CCH. On the right, we have priority order CHH. And there is a difference, even at this point, between the carbon on the left and the hydrogen on the right. Yes? No, because the oxygen's attached to the carbon that's attached to the carbon. It's two positions away. No, if you were to write in the other groups that are right there, you can see there are the two hydrogens. So CCH versus CHH. CCH is more important, and so that makes the group on the left priority number two. That makes the group on the right priority number three, and since we now have one, two, three in a circle like that, it really is S. To name the molecule, we don't worry about R, S, E, Z. We just name it in order of position numbers. So the aldehyde's still more important. It gets the lowest number. First group we come to that needs a descriptor is 3, and that is S. And then we have the double bond at 4, which is E. The hydroxy group is a substituent, so we name it first, 3-hydroxy. The rest of the molecule is part of the core name. It has 6 carbons, so it's hex. There is an alkene at position 4, so 4-ene. And then it has an aldehyde, which doesn't need a number. So then we just say al. Questions about that example? Well, then let's move on to ketones now. So ketones have the characteristic ending "-one". Unlike an aldehyde, a ketone is going to automatically be an internal functional group because you have to have alkyl groups on either side of it. Because of that, you have to show the position numbers of the carbonyls, always. Well, no, there is one exception, which I'll show you momentarily. For a regular ketone, again, we have to show the number. We're going to give this the lowest possible number. So if we numbered from the right, it would get position 2. If we numbered it from the left, we would get position 4. So it's a lower number from the right, and so we number from the right. 5 carbons, so it's pent. Otherwise, besides the carbonyl, it's saturated, so it's ane. And then we do have the carbonyl at the 2 position. So it's not 2-pentone, it's pentanone. What if we had more than one carbonyl? If we had more than one ketone on the same molecule? Well, we number to give the first carbonyl we run into the lowest possible number. It's not that all the numbers together need to be low. It's the very first one where there's a difference. And numbering from the left, the first one would be at 2. Numbering from the right, the first one would be at 3. So this time we're going to number from the left. So this is a 7-carbon compound. So it's hept, it's otherwise saturated, ane. We're going to put an E in this time because we're going to have a consonant follow. So up above, there was no E because after the pentane, we had one. We're going to have a trione this time. So that the word doesn't turn into pententrione, we still want that ane sound. That's why the E goes back in. Heptane, 2, 4, 5, trione. Just a couple more examples because we're running a little low on time. If we have an unsaturation, how do we tackle that? We still follow priority group order. So even though the alkene would get a lower number if we started with the alkene, it's the less important functional group. And so even though the ketone doesn't show up until position 2, we're going to still number that way. Again, because the ketone's the more important functional group. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No substituents. Pent, this time it's not saturated. It does have an alkene in it. 4-ene. Then we name the carbonyl. 2-one. What if we had an alcohol instead? Same situation. Even though the alcohol could have the number 1, it doesn't matter. The carbonyl gets the lowest possible number. So we again number from the left. An alcohol is less important than an aldehyde, so that means it gets its substituent name, hydroxy. It's at the 4 position. And this is a 4-carbon ketone, so it's butane, and then 2-one. Last one for now. If we have both an aldehyde and a ketone together, an aldehyde is more important than a ketone, so we can't use the one ending. We have to have some other way of naming the ketone. So it gets its own substituent name of oxo. Aldehyde more important, that establishes the numbering order. So this is 3. Oxobutanol. Questions? Well, then let's tackle the lab proper. Since we're so low on time, we'll do the mechanism and some other theoretical discussion on Tuesday when we have our next lab. Just to show you some notation that I believe your lab text presents and is very common, is that if you just wanted to show an oxidation was occurring but didn't care so much about showing the reagent, you can use the letter O in brackets just to, in general sense, show oxidation occurs. So you're going to take the compound cyclododecanol. You're going to do a bleach oxidation, a much cleaner type of oxidation than some of the common ones. And from that, we're going to make cyclododecanone. Now, to demonstrate that this is an oxidation, let's determine the oxidation state on the carbon where the functional group is. So what is the oxidation state of the carbon right next to the alcohol in the reagent? Now, how did you come up with that? And why is that? What is the system of oxidation state? So, oxidation state is really this fake number, just like formal charge is a fake number, where we try to assign a certain number of electrons to each of the atoms in a molecule. Well, if we have a bond, how do we decide where the electrons should be counted? Because if they're truly covalent bonds, then each atom that's part of a bond should get one electron from that bond. But if you have a polar bond, oxygen connected to a carbon, fluorine connected to something, that makes a highly polar bond. So it doesn't make sense necessarily to evenly count electrons. Well, we do both. For formal charge, we do treat everything as a purely covalent bond. So we break it homolytically, giving one electron to each atom. But for oxidation state, we do look at electronegativity. Now, the rules that you might have learned, and I know we must have covered this last quarter, I don't like them myself, because if you learn the oxidation state rules in Chem 1A the way that usually it's presented, the rules are oxygen is -2 except when it's -1 except when it's 0, and hydrogen is 1 except when it's 0 except when it's -1, and chlorine is -1 except when it's not, and fluorine even is -1 except when it's 0. So what kind of system of rules is that? It's all based off the logic of electronegativity. Now, what Dante was saying is if we look at the oxygen, we count it as -1 and look at the other atoms, that's correct, but I want to do it graphically. I want to disconnect the bonds to show how we would distribute the electrons. So let's simplify. And let's look at the things attached on the left here. So, carbon and carbon, they're the same electronegativity. What do we do in those situations? We count it as one electron on each carbon. Turn it back into a covalent-style bond. That's why carbons count as zero for oxidation states. Having a carbon attached counts as zero in terms of oxidation state. We have that oxygen of the alcohol. Ignoring the hydrogen and what happens with it, the oxygen would get two electrons from that bond, leaving carbon with none. So having the oxygen there, therefore, causes the carbon to have a +1 oxidation state. But there is also a hydrogen attached here. And because carbon is more electronegative than the hydrogen, it would get both electrons from the hydrogen. So having a hydrogen would give a carbon an oxidation state of -1. So we have one atom that would count or cause carbon to count as +1, one atom that would cause it as -1, so the oxidation state is 0. The other way to demonstrate that is by disconnecting the bonds in this way, we have shown carbon ending up with 4 electrons. How many electrons would carbon have as an unreacted element? How many valence electrons? 4. So since it has as many as it would have as if it had not reacted, that's why this has an oxidation state of 0. Now let's do the same method for the product. Again, graphically disconnecting carbon versus carbon, again, of equal electronegativity, so we give one electron to each of the carbons in the bond. Then oxygen is still more electronegative, so for each of the bonds, it would get the pair of electrons. This means that carbon ends up with just two electrons around it, versus the four it would have as an unreacted element. That's two fewer, and so that means it has
a plus two oxidation state.
So we've gone from zero to plus two, so yes, carbon really did get oxidized in this reaction. So again, we'll go into more detail about this on Tuesday. For now, what we need to do is have a brief crash course run through of the procedure for this reaction. Now, somehow yesterday when I did this with section one, I must not have elaborated on some of the topics as much as I did for you all in the afternoon, or maybe I just had more caffeine yesterday. But just to warn you all, what I did at this point is I turned to the first person that was sitting over there, so that'd be Alice in this case, and asked that person to tell me what would be the very first thing that, I think it was Gulsa, that she would do as soon as I stopped talking. And then went to the next person for the next step, and the next person for the next step, and the next person for the next step. I say this because there's a couple of you in just glancing over your pre-labs that I'm not entirely convinced you'd be able to do the experiment without having at some point to go back and look at your lab text. So I didn't make any markings, I didn't make any scores, but I'm just noticing that some of you put a little bit more effort in than others. Now that doesn't mean that if you had a 20-page pre-lab that that's good. It just means if you only have a paragraph, was that really complete enough? Did you get all the heating times, the different washes, the drying, the filtering, and all of that in there? So, because I am taking a bit more time though, I'll go ahead and tell you the procedure, what you're going to do. So first off, we're going to try to get away with not using the water condenser. So you have, well, we don't have a round bottom. Even though the procedure calls it round bottom, we're using the pear-shaped. So you're going to have a pear-shaped flask that you were supposed to have a water condenser on, but with the water condenser you have to have the hoses connected up, and it's just a bit more of a hassle, and someone invariably ends up squirting water everywhere trying to set it up. The air condenser, fortunately, is going to do the job for us because the boiling point of the mixture ends up not being too high. Now, at some point in the procedure where it says to heat at reflux, if you don't remember what that is, that means heat that flask to the point where you have gentle boiling, not boiling all over the place, but gentle boiling so that the vapor is rising up that condenser tube, but as it rises up the tube, it cools back down, recondenses, and then falls back into the flask again. So you end up with your own little chemical waterfall continuously running inside of your flask. If that level of the solvent, the point to which it advances, if it goes too far up the tube, it looks like it's going to about to go out the top, then you would just be boiling everything away and we would need to switch. But in neither of the sections yesterday did anybody tell me, at least, they had to switch to the water condenser. So let's use the air condenser. It's sort of a shape and bake reaction. You're supposed to mix various quantities of a few of the reagents. There's glacial acetic acid, which is concentrated acetic acid. There's acetone, which is acting as a solvent. And there's one other preparatory reagent, isn't there? Oh, the cyclododecanol itself. Then, and I notice I didn't catch this carefully enough in the first section, it says to add the bleach. But some people in the morning section, I think, felt that it was cook it for half an hour, add the bleach. No, it says add it over a half an hour, which means, yes, you add like a few drops and wait, and a few more drops and wait, and a few more drops, and you do that for half an hour. So just want to make sure you interpret that correctly. We'll see if we get better yields in this class than the others just by this timing. Generally, if there's a direction to do it over time, there's a reason for that. So you cook it and add it for a certain length of time, you have these starch strips you're supposed to use to check the progress of the reaction, correct? And so the logic behind it is this. If you have the cyclododecanol that you're oxidizing, the bleach is going to get destroyed. Let's say you didn't put enough bleach in. Then after it's reacted, when you test the strip, you won't get any kind of color change because there's no bleach there. Now, maybe you had exactly the right amount of bleach, but you can't be sure. So that's why it says to keep on adding if you don't get a response on the paper, to make sure that we have an excess of the bleach, because the worst thing that'll happen is we used excess bleach. So that's the purpose of the starch paper. Yes? You should use a sand bath, because especially if people get that far, we use ether as one of the things we extract with, and so we can't use any other source of heat. So the very first thing, in fact, you do after I stop talking is run and get your sand baths turned on. Now, it does say something about monitoring temperature. Instead of monitoring the temperature of the reaction itself, monitor the temperature of the sand bath. And I would recommend heating it up a good 50 or so degrees beyond the temperature it wants you to maintain the solution at, because there's so much heat loss from the sand bath versus the glassware. So maybe even 100 degrees or so for the sand bath would be appropriate. That means, though, again, because of heat loss inefficiency, your hot plate, you might want to turn up to 150 degrees, 200 degrees at first. Make sure, though, if the temperature starts crawling up too much, that you do bring it back down. But yes, we're going to be using a sand bath to heat this up. Now, after you've heated it and stirred it and added the iodine and ensured that there's, not iodine, bleach, and if you ensured that there's enough bleach there, you're ready to then start isolating your material, correct? Which, let me duck out of the room a moment and go get a separatory button, because I want to review a little bit about using separatory buttons. Stopper that goes with it. So just imagine a stopper there. Because then you should also imagine a little bit of a paper towel that you have underneath the stopper, because this is a ground glass connector. And I think I mentioned this ground glass connector when we checked in on Tuesday. It's a way of creating a pretty decent seal. Usually, though, you put some grease on it. Now, in this case, we don't normally put grease on here. The reason you normally would need to put grease with a ground glass joint is it could freeze otherwise. So if we don't use the grease, when you're done with the separatory funnel, please make sure to put that little piece of paper towel underneath, because we have had problems in the past where these sit for a while, they kind of clank against each other, maybe that glass gets ground in just a little too much, and it does stick. Now, as far as using the separatory funnel, remember that if the nozzle is turned so that it is parallel with the flow of the funnel, that it is on. It's when it's perpendicular to it that it is off. Just make sure that you do have it off before you start pouring stuff in here. Otherwise, it's going to pour all out. Oh, by the way, if you all got the email, you all saw the note about appropriate lab attire, correct? I think your section, I might have already mentioned it, but I didn't for sections 1 and 2. So just to make sure I've told all 3 sections. The main restrictions that we have is that for shoes, they can't be open-toed or open anything. The only hole there should be is the one for your foot to go into. I think I even mentioned in the email things like Crocs. I know sometimes those are popular, but they got holes in strange places. And the idea of not having holes in your shoes is because gravity works, because things fall down, and your feet stick out. Well, hopefully that's the thing that sticks out. But therefore, you can't have any holes in the top of your shoes, because imagine that you had a strong base or something that got... I had a student once that said to me that, Dr. Gray, you need to start working out more. You're going to start erasing the board with your stuff. That was a few years ago when I didn't have as good a habit. So anyway. So shoes, no holes in the top. So hopefully you all did see that, and hopefully none of you have inappropriate footwear. Because if you did show up with the wrong kind of lab clothing, I would have to send you home to go get other clothes. It's part of the reason why I had suggested just having a separate set of clothes that you could keep as an emergency to change into, or to change into in case you forgot, oh yeah, I'm going to Latin today. The other things that you have to have, pants, skirts, sweats, whatever, that goes down to the ankles. Again, things fall down, your legs are below the rest of you, and so that's why you want long clothes, just to make sure that you don't get any spills on them. As far as tops, we don't have any specific restrictions, but again, the less skin that you've got showing, the less chance you're going to get chemically contaminated. I'm going to order myself a lab coat because I can't believe all these years I haven't had one. If you're a chem major, you might want to have one for your own self just so you could be the cool chem nerd. Goggles. That's the last thing we do have to have, which, yes, we have the communal goggles here, but given that this is flu and cold season, do you really want to be using a communal set of goggles every day? The answer is yes, because you've got a fantastic immune system. Fine, more power to you. Otherwise, I recommend that you get your own set of goggles. Now, those of you who are going to be science majors and in it for the long haul, if you wear glasses, there are such things as prescription safety goggles. If you were to ever invest in something like that, just make sure you do get the kind that go all the way around your eye, that they don't look like normal glasses. They are actually lab goggles. So anyways, back to this. Oh, that's right, because I was thinking about this spilling out if you didn't remember to close it. To use this thing, you'll have your solution in here, put the stopper on it, make sure it's closed, turn it upside down, shake it, but not too rough at first, especially if you're using a volatile solvent like ether. You want to open this up and vent the pressure, close it back off again, shake it again, vent pressure, do it one last time. Don't open it, invert it, let it layers settle. And that's how to properly use the separatory funnel. Now we quickly run through some of the operations that you are doing with that. Draw sort of a flow chart. I forgot to bring my scanner. Actually didn't forget, it was left with my other computer somewhere, and I won't have it again until this afternoon. But I'll leave the notes here just laying out on the front somewhere if you wanted to look at the roadmap I'm about to draw, just in case you don't remember exactly what's a wash versus what's an extraction. So at the end of a reaction, you're supposed to have two layers, aren't you? And then you simply pour your entire reaction mixture first into the separatory funnel to separate out the aqueous and organic layers. Is that correct? I'm asking because I didn't read word for word the procedure. I'm just trusting you really did do your pre-lab. So that's correct what I described? Okay. So that means at what we'll call the start, you're going to have two layers. Now, which layer is going to be the organic layer, the top or the bottom? That's curious you didn't answer it right away, because both other sections right away said top. Which, why would that have been normally a safe guess? Because usually organic solvents, organic mixtures are less dense than water. The notable exceptions are generally the halogenated solvents, so things like chloroform, methylene, chloride. Since we don't have halogenated solvents in this case, the top layer would be a good guess, and I didn't ask after I did the lab lecture, but no one mentioned it, so I'm presuming it really did end up being the top. How could we confirm whether the organic layer was the top or the bottom layer? Drop some water in. Why? What would happen? So if you had the aqueous layer on top, which means organic on the bottom, when you drop the water in, it's just going to combine with that top layer and possibly make the top layer look larger, depending on how much water you add in. If you add in and the aqueous layer is instead the bottom layer, so if the organic is what's floating on top, well, then the water would just go through the organic layer and end up in that bottom layer. So that's how you can confirm. If somebody, just to for my future knowledge, let me know once you get to the extractions or the separations, which one is which. But I'm going to guess that it is the top layer that's the organic. So the first thing we do is drain off the aqueous layer. Then drain out the organic layer.
Then take that aqueous layer, put it right back in the separatory funnel. Then add diethyl ether.
We're going to be doing an extraction.
So again, we'll end up with two layers. The water layer.
You simply dispose of. Your reagent should have been in the organic layer to begin with, but there's always some residual solubility of organics in water, and so that's why we added some ether. Make sure when you do this extraction that you do be careful shaking, but that you do a good amount of shaking to get as much contact with the ether, with the organics that might be still trapped in the water. But once we've done this first extraction, you only do one extraction with ether, right? It's not a multiple extraction? Okay. So then you can dispose of the aqueous layer.
You then combine the two aqueous layers together.
And you're going to put it back into the separatory funnel and to do a series of washes. Now let me just in general show you a roadmap for what a wash is, and then I'll just list the different washes that we're going to be doing.
So you start with the organic. You add whatever wash that you're going to add. Shake it up. Repeat it. End up with the two layers. And then you drain and dispose of the aqueous layer so that the organic layer just stays in your flask the whole time.
This, of course, is a much easier process if and when the organic layer is less dense, because then it does just sit there and float on top the whole time. If we had something like we had the first quarter, where at one point we were doing extraction with methylene chloride, same process would occur. It's just that every time you'd have to drain the organic layer out, then drain the water layer, and then put the organic layer back in. Now, again, this wash process, is this exact sequence, you'll repeat three times total, I believe, isn't it? First, with sodium bicarbonate.
Which is to neutralize excess acid. Followed by sodium bisulfite, which is to reduce excess bleach. Finally, followed by sodium chloride, which is to force out ionic impurities.
Is there a fourth wash with just plain water, or is that the last one? That's it. So then there's a drying and filtering, potentially a distillation step. I don't think we're going to have time for that, but I'll describe all the rest of that on Tuesday, because we are at the edge of way too late now. Any questions before I turn you loose? Now, did we assign fume hood positions in this section? So before you all disappear to the stockroom line, if we could take a moment where you would all just stand in front of your fume hoods, because I would prefer that you just keep one fume hood position for the quarter. Don't use H5 because that's where the wash station is. Don't use H13 because that's where the chemicals will go. But otherwise, once we've done that, you can go ahead and start.